One of the ancient classic anthologies of Dharma sayings goes back, presumably, to the time of the Buddha. It's a collection of kind of verses that the Buddha said, many of the teachings in the ancient times were spoken in beautiful ways as poetry, as verses, partly because it was easier to remember that way, and partly because if things were stated beautifully, then they would enter the heart in a more deeper way than just a prose kind of discussion. And so the Dhammapada is filled with beautiful poetry, much of which is a little bit obscure to us because even if we know Pali, it's difficult to kind of recapture the meter of the ancient language. But it's a very important text for Buddhists. And in the second chapter, it opens with this verse. And the English will not do any justice to the poetry of the original, but it goes something like this. Attention is the path to the deathless. Inattention is the path to death. Those who are attentive never die. Those who are inattentive are as if already dead. Attention is the path to the deathless. The deathless is a very important concept in Buddhism. And we sometimes talk about having the experience of the deathless as being synonymous to the experience of freedom, of waking up, of enlightenment. And it's interesting that the Buddha chose the word deathless as a very central concept for his teaching or the goal of the practice, the experience of liberation. Because what the Buddha was doing was taking a concept which already existed in the Indian religions of his time and redefined it. And you see the Buddha doing that repeatedly. Rather than going into conflict with people directly and saying, well, forget that word, or that's the wrong idea, he would often take a little kind of, maybe it was subversive to do this, but he would actually take the word and say, okay, but this is what the word really means. So for example, with India had and still does, has a caste system. People are born into different castes, something which the Buddha was not very keen on. And so rather than kind of having a kind of a frontal assault on this idea and saying it's just a bunch of baloney, he said, oh, a Brahmin, which is the highest caste, a Brahmin. Oh, the Buddha said, oh, a person who is really a Brahmin is not a Brahmin because they're born that way, but because they live virtuously. They live ethically. And someone who lives upright life, that person's really a Brahmin. So it's a little bit, it takes an existing term and then kind of redefines it in a way that makes it work for him. And the concept of the deathless was similar. In ancient Vedic religions, thousands of years before the Buddha, there was a great quest for looking for immortality, for having experience of not dying anymore. And so was part of the supplication and sacrificing to the deities that they did in ancient India was partly for well-being in this life, but it was partly also an attempt to have a favorable rebirth. So in being reborn, you can be born into what's the deathless, into immortality. As some of you might know, in Chinese religion also, there was a tremendous desire for immortality. I guess maybe it's a kind of basic human quest, because people don't want to die. Many people don't. And so looking for some kind of experience of immortality. So the Buddha took this central concept of the religions of his time and he redefined it. And so he kept the deathless as being a central pillar of what he was pointing to. But he no longer talked about it as being, you will become immortal, that now you're going to live forever. But rather he talked about it as an experience. An experience of the deathless. So he put it into the realm of what we can experience as opposed to the realm of some permanent existence. And it could, in a sense, say that or it might imply that the Buddha was making some kind of dualistic pointing to something external to himself. There's something out there which is the deathless, that never dies, is never born, it's always there, it's timeless. And you can touch that thing, that reality which is out there, which is somewhere, wherever it might be. And then you can, you know, it'll do something for you. You realize your true nature, realize the true nature of reality. And once you realize the true nature of reality, the core of how things actually are, that they're deathless, some deathless quality of reality, of existence, of the universe or something, that will be liberating for you. You realize that, you know, if you realize who your true nature is, then all the ways in which we're trying to define ourselves or support or prop ourselves up is no longer necessary, and you can be quite at rest and at peace in this life. But I don't think the Buddha was talking about it as being something external or separate or dualistic to yourself. In talking about an experience of the deathless, I think he was talking about the nature of experience itself. Not what you can experience, but something about experience itself. So he could say attention, the word is appamada, not sati, but you could say mindfulness, you could say awareness, is the path to the deathless. But actually the Pali allows for it to be translated slightly differently also. Attention is the path of deathlessness, of the deathless. And it's a little bit, to say it's to the deathless means it's somewhere in the future. To say it's the path of deathlessness means that it's like this is the road that is called deathless. Every time you take a step on it, you're walking in the step, you're in touch with deathlessness, with the deathless. So a couple of things. So he was redefining what he meant by the deathless, what was meant by the deathless. And then he was saying that attention is a key element to your relationship to the deathless. The ultimate goal that Buddha was talking to of spiritual practice is found through the practice of attention, of mindfulness, of awareness, of heedfulness. Now, this is interesting for a number of reasons. One is that attention is something we all have. It's something my mother told me all the time growing up. Pay attention, Gil. You're not paying attention. So I knew that I had it, from at least, you know, she thought I had it from a very early age. It's something we all have. Awareness, attention, mindfulness. And one of the things we're doing in practice is developing, strengthening our capacity to be attentive, strengthening our capacity to be aware. As we develop our awareness, or our attention, we start noticing some of the special qualities of attention, special qualities of knowing, of awareness. And that is, awareness itself is a very plain, matter-of-fact thing. Or say it this way, awareness itself is a relatively neutral event. Though neutral maybe doesn't do it justice, in that awareness itself doesn't judge what it is aware of. So in the ancient metaphor of awareness is that of a mirror. Awareness in and of itself is like a mirror, that whatever comes in front of the mirror doesn't mind. It's a beautiful face, fine, it'll reflect it back. It's an angry face, fine, the mirror will reflect it back. The mirror doesn't mind. The face goes away, no problem. Many faces crowd the mirror, no problem. The mirror just simply reflects what is there, with no judgment, just stays true for what it is. So that metaphor then is applied to awareness. In and of itself, as the awareness gets stronger, you see the awareness itself doesn't judge anything, doesn't push anything away, doesn't hold on to anything, doesn't try to manipulate anything. It just simply reflects what is there. Just simply knows, oh, this is what's happening now. The birds are singing. We know the birds are chirping. and we can, of course, we can do things to that. we can say, oh, that's a pretty chirping, or that's, you know, those birds. I wish it was, you know, a nightingale instead or something. Or we could say, you know, they're interfering with this Dharma talk, you know. And let's send someone out. We should have a bird patrol. Every day goes out and chases them away so we can be silent here during the meditation. Because I can't stand it. It's interrupting my meditation. My attempt to be peacefully present is being interrupted by the presence of those birds. Or, you know, oh, those are great. You know, I had the most wonderful meditation today, and those birds just really kind of set the tone. And I think next time I'm coming, I'll bring my tape recorder, and I'm going to tape those sounds, and I hope they're here next week. And you know, maybe I should go to the pet store and find out what kind of food those kinds of birds like to have, so that there are really a lot of them come next week. We have a really lot of chirping. And so we get involved. And we often don't see how quickly we get involved with our experience. We don't just let it be at the knowing stage, at the level of just pure awareness, just simple awareness. But we start to very, very quickly get involved. And most of us, most of the time, don't notice how quickly we get involved. How we've actually not just resting in the pure awareness of experience, but we're involved with judging it, criticizing it, wanting to change it, wanting to keep it the same, relating it to what it means to me, you know, what I want from it, what it has to do, you know. There's all these things we do to it. And the realm of what we do to our experience is the realm where suffering arises. Suffering itself never arises in the realm of awareness itself, just simply knowing something. And you can see this very dramatically, and many of you know this, it's just kind of old news for people who have meditated for a long time. And you can see that very clearly with experience of pain, especially like in meditation. Your knee hurts, your back hurts, something hurts. And you can see how it's possible simply to know that pain. And the mind can be completely equanimous, completely at peace. And maybe it's a long time in coming to realize that, because mostly what you know is that you feel pain and your mind is contracted. Your body gets tense. And you're filled with racing thoughts about, my God, you know, this guy up there who's supposed to ring the bell is falling asleep. You know, why am I sitting with someone who doesn't know how to keep time? You know, they, you know, him, you know, what's going on here? Or, you know, or I got to get out of here no matter what, you know, or maybe if no one notices I can move, or there's all these ways. Then we kind of hate the pain, we contract around it, we may come to conclusions about it. Oh my God, if I sit one more minute with this toe pain, I'm sure my toe is going to fall off. And maybe it's not just simply a structural problem, you know, my circulation's been cut, but rather it must mean that I have some tremendous malignant disease in my toe, and I better figure out how to get to a doctor first thing, as soon as he rings that bell. When is he going to ring that bell? So we get involved very quickly. But in pain, sometimes we can see that the involvement is separate from the pain itself and is actually optional. We don't have to have it to actually go on. That the awareness itself doesn't require it to be followed up with all these judgments and ideas and manipulations and concerns. And I mentioned pain as the example because for some people, for many people, it's one of the more powerful places to learn this teaching. There's all kinds of other places you can learn it, but you're really motivated to learn it there. If you're having this wonderful experience of bliss, we might not be so motivated to see how our involvement with the bliss, the way we've gotten complicated with it, by entangled with it, by saying, oh, I'm the perfect meditator, I hope everyone notices, you know, that I'm sitting here with radiating light in all directions. And we don't see it because it's quite pleasant. You know, why bother, you know, interrupting or freeing yourself from your delusions if your delusions are really pleasant, right? But if you want to practice seriously, you have to be willing to kind of learn how to be independent, free of all delusions, whether they're pleasant or unpleasant. So there's something about awareness which is very pristine, very pure, very maybe neutral. And so you find in the Buddhist tradition, some Buddhists, Buddhist teachers, poets, who create or songwriters, They create beautiful literary works, songs, praising in beautiful language, like they're praising a great lover, awareness itself. They call it, you know, the primordial luminosity of awareness, the elixir of immortality, they go on and on. You go on pages after pages of these wonderful epithets, you know, and only if you have some kind of a love affair with awareness would you really get into it. And wow, you know, it's like you're in love with some wonderful person, you know, it's great love and lust and desire and fantasy and all this stuff, and some great poet writes an endless, you know, ode to this person, and you just sit down, you're ready to read it forever because it's just so great. If you don't have this great appreciation for awareness, some of these poems, you know, don't quite work. But hopefully you'll begin appreciating how wonderful awareness is. So I say this as a way of emphasizing that there are Buddhists who have tremendous, profound appreciation of what awareness provides us, what it is in and of itself. So a lot of what mindfulness practice entails is looking very carefully at things, investigating, seeing clearly the nature of things, how things are, so that eventually the attention gets strong enough, the awareness becomes clear enough, that we begin to separate our awareness from what we're paying attention to. To some degree, not you can't separate it completely, but to some degree, to see that awareness and knowing is actually separate from what it is we're knowing. And this is a phenomenally liberating thing to do, because most of us are completely entangled with what we know. So much so that it's kind of like we're being led around by the nose by the objects of the world. There was some English doctor from the 1800s who apparently, he was quoted as saying, "My life is in the hands of the next fool who gets me angry." And in fact, the story continues, he died with having a heart attack in a fit of rage. So, you know, he was so entangled with what people say or do and stuff like that, that, you know, he got his ire and his anger up. And when you have spent a lot of time angry, it puts a great stress on people's hearts, as we know. But to not be entangled. So one of the verses that is very hard to translate into English from the Dhammapada says something like this. It says, if like a broken bell that does not reverberate, you do not reverberate, you will not have any more hostility and will have an experience of freedom. If somehow the experience of the world doesn't cause us to react, that inability to react, that freedom to not react, not the inability to react, but the freedom not to react, will free us from all hostility and will be a kind of taste of freedom. So what I'm pointing to here today is the centrality of attention, of mindfulness, which is what our practice is. And what gets interesting is that mindfulness, awareness, is in many ways religiously neutral or theologically neutral, doctrinally neutral. Our simple ability to know something does not require a context of any kind of religious teaching explaining it or adding meaning to it or purpose to it. So you can hear the chirping of the birds, and it's just a chirping of the birds. But it's also this ability to be aware is a tool. So it's also possible to add various understandings and contexts to attention that adds meaning to it, purpose to it, that harnesses it for the purposes of change, of spiritual practice, of development and change. So one of the classic ways in which the Buddha talked about awareness was awareness is a key element of a gradual path of progress. That if you apply your attention to your breath and develop some stability and calm with your breathing, and then learn to apply attention to different parts of your life and how you react to things, that you will slowly become more peaceful, more at home, more settled, less in conflict with yourself and the world, and eventually you'll have a taste of liberation, of freedom, the freedom from all conflict. But awareness, or attention, or mindfulness can also exist in different contexts, with different understandings. Your awareness doesn't care. The mirror doesn't care. If the mirror is used as a rear view mirror in a car, or it's used in the powder room of the Queen of England, or if it's used, at the end of some medical instrument that gets around the corner of someone's mouth, like a dentist, right? That has little mirrors, right? And so it puts in your mouth a little mirror, and it helps them see the back of your teeth, and so the dentist can do a lot more careful work on your teeth, which is good, right? So a mirror can be used for all kinds of purposes. And the same thing with mindfulness. It can be used for all kinds of purposes. Someone who wants to be a better fighter could benefit a lot from strengthening and developing their mindfulness. Someone who wants to become a better, offer more compassion to the world, would do well in developing more mindfulness. So there's many understandings. So one of the great beauties to appreciate in mindfulness is that mindfulness in and of itself is doctrinally neutral, is theologically neutral. In and of itself, it doesn't automatically have a religious teaching that goes with it. So it lends itself, actually, then to a lot of different kinds of teachings. And if you listen to different teachers, you'll find that they have different contexts and understandings of what mindfulness is used for. One of the traditional ways of understanding, as I said, is that it involves a gradual developmental model of practice. But there's another model. And that model, the model of gradual practice, is to translate the line, attention is the path to deathlessness. But there's another model or another purpose for mindfulness practice, another way of understanding it, where that line maybe could be translated, attention is the path of deathlessness. That the ultimate is not someplace far away. It's not a matter of developing yourself for endless years of endless retreats, and then eventually when your concentration and mindfulness is strong enough, then you'll have some glimpse of the deathless. But there's something that's available to you right now, as you're sitting here, as you're listening to me, which is of the nature of deathless, of the deathless. So what is that? And so some teachers will point to that. It's not a matter of development in the future, but something about right here and right now, where you'll find freedom, find your release, find the deathless. So where do you find it right now? You find it in what I'm saying? Oh, this, what Gil's saying makes sense to me. Or it doesn't make sense to me. That confusion has been around for a long time. Maybe that's the deathless. Or is it in a certain presence that some person brings? I know that some people go to a teacher's guru and they feel some real presence in that person's presence. And they say, oh, that must be it. Is it a thing? Is it something you can point to? And maybe it's not. Maybe it's to be found in the nature of experience itself, the nature of knowing itself. So it doesn't matter what you know. Listening to my voice, feeling your knees aching, those of you sitting on the floor perhaps, or feeling the backrest of your chair, feeling your feet against the floor, feeling your breathing. Whatever it is, doesn't matter. There's something in the nature of the experience itself which partakes of the deathless. And then maybe, perhaps, there's something in the nature of experience itself which is a key to our freedom. Now, in the time of the Buddha, and also in more recent times, but you find a lot of stories where the Buddha would give a discourse, would say something. Sometimes it was just a few sentences, sometimes it was a whole discourse. And at the end of the discourse, someone would be enlightened. They would be released. And they didn't spend years of practice, but rather they tasted something. The Buddha was able to point to something that they were able to experience right now that freed them. And there were stories in the ancient texts of some people who never got it, or it took years and years and years and years of practice before they understood or got a taste of what that is. And maybe it depends on personality types, dispositions, or who knows what the difference is. But because there are some people who could experience it immediately, the suggestion is that it's actually theoretically available to all of us immediately, right now. There's something about freedom, about liberation, about awakening, which is right here in this room, in each of you right now. And this doesn't involve endless years of practice. It doesn't involve a lot of complicated theology or doctrine of Buddhism. So what is it in your experience right now that partakes in freedom? What is it right now that you can think? Is there something right now that you can point to or see or feel or sense that feels precious, that feels pristine, that feels liberating? Or do you have thoughts, judgments, ideas? Oh, this is ridiculous. Or not me. I couldn't do that. Maybe someone else can do it, who spiritual genius, but not me. Or what's this guy talking about? Or, you know, or I know what he's talking about. He's talking about that thing I experienced when I was 6 years old. That thing, that peace that I had, or something. You very quickly make something happen. But what happens if you don't engage yourself with a judgment, an idea, a concept, a criticism, a rejection, an approval? What is left? What is left that might have some bearing on your possibility to feel tremendous peace and ease in life right now? It's like the exercise that I've given a few times now, maybe here. If you take away all the ideas that you have of who you are based on memory, based on who you've been in the past, mistakes you made in the past, the accomplishments you made in the past, what other people have told you about you in the past, take away all ideas of who you are based on memory. And you take away all ideas of who you're going to be, who you want to be, what you're going to be, all ideas of the future and how it relates to who you are. And you take away all ideas of comparing yourself to others, and all ideas of how other people think about you. What's left then? Can you find yourself when you take away all those things? Because you do not depend on any of those things. Those are actually kind of relatively shallow ideas. They're just concepts, after all. They can't really point to who we really are in our depths. But most of us relate to ourselves through one of those four categories. But if you're able to take away all those categories, what is left in the present moment right now? Who are you right now then? Who you are right now, when you take away those categories, partakes the experience of freedom. Is very close to the possibility of being free. Or maybe it's the same thing. What is it in the nature of who you are right now and your experience of yourself right now which partakes in freedom? Another term for the deathless, another way that the Buddha talked about it, Well, you talked about it being the timeless. And perhaps the timeless is a word which has a little more meaning for us than the deathless. We're not ancient Indians concerned about immortality. Most of us know better, maybe not. But many of us are concerned with time. I mean, that's like the time suffering is like the big thing, right? And how many of us have, someone showed me their Palm Pilot just a little while ago. And the wonderful thing about the Palm Pilot was that you have your calendar, right? You schedule yourself. And then it beeps when that time comes for you to do that thing. So you don't have to even think about things. So we schedule ourselves, and it'd be the greatest invention at all if we can just kind of stretch the hour to be timeless, because then we can get a lot done. But the deathless is also called the timeless, that which has no time. And I think the only thing that qualifies as the timeless, if it is the timeless present. And the timeless present, if it's going to be liberating, is not some external thing, but also is some aspect of our experience itself. It's not a thing out there, but it's in the nature of experience itself. So again, if you go back now and kind of just be present for how you're experiencing, listening, reflecting, thinking, feelings, breathing, is there some quality of timelessness that can be found in that? Some people only have a taste of this timelessness in very extreme, dangerous situations. Maybe many of you had the experience of being on the road driving and just missing an accident. That, you know, you realize, wow, you know, if that accident actually happened, I'd probably be dead now. But just, you just missed it by a hair. And maybe in the moments or minutes after that, all the preoccupations, concerns, and fantasies and daydreams that you had just before that have somehow been cleared away. And there's something very timeless about the next minutes before you start kind of reflecting, oh, what happened? And you start sweating or something. Everything becomes very, very still. So the timeless present is always here, of course. But to the degree to which we're always looking ahead, looking behind us in the past, trying to manipulate things, we don't notice the timelessness of the present. The present never changes, even though the things within the present moment change all the time. There's some quality of sensing or feeling or experience which it feels like everything's happening in a timeless, within the context of being timeless, the timeless present. And the beautiful thing about that is the timeless present that the Buddha experienced is exactly the same timeless present which exists right now. That if we relate to what is timeless, there's no distance in time between us and the Buddha. Timelessness is eternal. Timelessness neither is born nor dies. It's the deathless. It's of the nature of our experience. If we start looking for it externally, we won't find it. If we start looking for it in the things that arise and pass away, we won't find it. We only find it in our momentary experience of right now. Whether we carry that with us beyond death, who knows? Who cares? I don't think the Buddha was pointing towards immortality that way. Or once you have it, once there's something about the way we experience our experience if we pay attention. That it feels deathless, it feels independent, it feels free, it feels liberated. So you find some teachers who then specialize in focusing on mindfulness, attention, not as a way to get someplace, but rather encouraging you to wake up to what's happening right now, who you are right now, nature of experience right now. And then you find some teachers in between who realize that they're just different contexts, different ways of talking, different, and that in some contexts one is the best way to talk about, one is useful, in other contexts another one is useful. And they don't want to kind of say it's one way or the other, but rather will say what is most useful at different times. But remember, there were people at the time of the Buddha and contemporary people nowadays who will hear teachings. And somehow the way they register those teachings, they hear them, transforms them completely, dramatically, fully. I don't know what it is that takes to make that transformation in people. But one of the things it takes is to take the possibility of freedom, of peace, really seriously. And perhaps the people who are transformed just hearing a word are the people that prepared themselves enough to take some teachings really seriously. The first person who was enlightened after the Buddha started teaching, and the Buddha gave his first teaching, was enlightened on hearing the teachings on the Four Noble Truths. And I think that if you take the Four Noble Truths seriously, you could walk out of this room today and not feel any more conflict with yourself and the world around you. It's not that far away, the possibility of freedom. But most of us don't want it enough. We have other things we actually want more. So, therefore we have to take the slow path, gradually, gradually, gradually. And maybe the slow path is only slow because until we want it enough, so we can see very clearly into the present moment and see the freedom that's possible right here. So may all of you take the possibility of freedom, take the possibility of being without any conflict at all in the world, seriously. That all of you and all everyone at Stanford Hospital may be conflict-free. May all beings be happy. Thank you.